Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join our conversation on the exchange, feel free. Phone numbers are as follows, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Think of the importance of tomorrow in our culture. Scarlett O'Hara saying she'll worry tomorrow. Annie in the Broadway musical singing she loves tomorrow. She's right, it is just a day away. But if we have something to do that is due tomorrow, we forced ourselves to work feverishly and probably sloppily as well. Procrastination certainly has its impacts, not just on the latest project you put off until the last minute, but long term. Today's guest spent much of the last 20 years looking into the impacts. He's written a short, to-the-point book called Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, a concise guide to strategies for change. Timothy Pitchell is a psychologist and associate professor of psychology at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario. His research and writing about procrastination began in 1995 and now includes the I Procrastinate podcasts and the Don't Delay blog for Psychology Today. His website is procrastination.ca, as in Canada. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and thanks for that introduction.
So what made procrastination the focus of your work? What made you decide to stop putting it off and get into it?
Well, I didn't ever start to study procrastination. I was studying people's goal pursuit, the kind of things people were doing and trying to do and how it affected their well-being. What I quickly found out is that when we fail to do what we say we're going to do, when our volitional action breaks down, it really depresses us. And so that's when I turned a corner. I stopped studying what people were doing and instead started studying what they said they were going to do and never got around to.
It depresses us, I mean, as in clinical depression?
Oh, yes. It goes both ways, though. It's if you're clinically depressed, we want to deal with that first because procrastination and motivation is part of depression. But certainly it's a downward spiral when we stop doing the things we intend to do because it's the pursuit of meaningful goals in our lives that really contributes daily to our well-being.
So what is the procrastination research group that you lead?
Well, back in 95, when I turned a corner and said I'm going to start studying procrastination, I realized there wasn't a lot published in the area. There's a leading researcher in Chicago by the name of Joseph Ferrari, and he and I got together and started to do some research, and as well as a lot of other students and academics. So we formed this procrastination research group, and it's just sort of hung on since then.
There are some issues and potential jokes that come to mind in finding research participants. We'll hold our tongues here for a moment. But
everyone wants to participate. When I go to a party, it's like, oh, you should study me, or better yet, you should study my husband.
Really? Well, that's interesting. So volunteers abound, it sounds like.
Well, yes, because as you said in the intro, do we all procrastinate? Yes, we do, but that doesn't mean we're all, quote, procrastinators. But it's kind of built into human nature to want to feel good now.
All right, so it's a real short-term gain kind of thing. It's like, I feel good not doing that thing I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and it's a double. There's a double edge to that. If I put it off because it gives me short-term mood repair, I feel better when I put something off. When we think about our future emotions, we base a lot of it on the present. And so that's called presentism. It's work that Dan Gilbert's done out of Harvard University. And when we rely on our present emotions, well, right now I feel pretty good because I just put off something I've been really not wanting to do. And so part of me actually believes tomorrow I'll feel more like doing it. And we know that's it's just not true.
Is there any better feeling about, I mean, even among some people to be able to say on Thursday, well, I said on Wednesday I was going to do this and here I am now. I'm doing it, darn it.
Well, we've done research we call experience sampling research where we put pagers on people and page them throughout the week. And we'd ask them, what are you doing? Oh, I'm hanging out with my friends, having a coffee. And what do you think about that? Well, it's enjoyable. It's not very difficult. And I'm feeling pretty good. Is there something else you should be doing? Oh, yes. And they tell us what they should be doing. Now, later in the week, when they finally get to doing what they were avoiding, because most people finally do get to it, none of them spontaneously say the kind of things they said earlier in the week. Earlier in the week, they said things like, well, I'll feel more like doing it tomorrow, or my best, I work better under pressure. Nobody spontaneously says that at the last minute. They often say things like, this isn't nearly as difficult as I thought, and if I'd only started earlier, I could probably do a better job. And therein lies the truth, of course.
Is there also some like, oh my God, I really thought I'd feel better about doing this now, and I don't?
Well, of course. And then, so we did look at their emotions and their evaluation of the tasks at hand and the kind of things they were saying to themselves. And I think everyone knows it to be true. Although there are a lot of people who say, no, 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 I do my best work under pressure, where the truth is, and we do experimental research, we see people make more errors under pressure. And if it's a writing project, well, there's no time for revision. But you've got rose-colored glasses on when you finish at the last minute because you got that huge rush of, I did it again. And the truth of the matter is, it's not that we work better under pressure, that we're able to work under pressure. And there's a bit of pathos in there that we don't kind of come to terms with.
But that emotion you just described, is that like I cross the finish line even if I'm like missing a leg and a shoe and all that stuff?
It's exactly it. It does feel fantastic, of course. But there's other things that are going on there too. For some people, there's a lot of self-handicapping going on at that point, in the sense that, you know, if I leave it to the last minute and I do really well, well, aren't I a genius? And I leave it to the last minute and I do poorly, well, I start at the last minute. I don't have to put myself on the line. And at that point, we're crossing a really gray line between procrastination and more strategic delay, because we're using delay as a bit of a self-defense mechanism. And that's a major point here, is that, you know, that all delay isn't procrastination. Certainly, procrastination is delay, but it's a negative form of delay. It's that voluntary delay. Even though we know we intended to do the task now, nobody's standing in the way except ourselves, and we got this vague feeling that we're going to pay for this. And that's what I'm studying, not just delay, but procrastination.
Tim Pitchell, this is not a big book, Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. Did you start to write a big one and realize it would only cause some people to put off doing other things?
Oh, that's so much the truth. In the introduction, I begin there. I say, you know, if you're reading this, it's probably because you're procrastinating. And I know that, you know, one of the best compliments I got paid about this book were two friends of mine, one who has both who have some sort of learning disorders, and they said to me, this is the first book I've finished in years, and that's what I set out to do, and I'm proud of that.
All right, Tim Pitchell, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, psychology professor at Carleton University in Ottawa. His book is Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. We'll come back and talk about how to do that, the solving part of things, after we do a little more diagnosis first. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Pitchell and you when we come back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is a psychologist, Dr. Timothy Pitchell, working out of Carleton University in Ottawa. He's been studying procrastination with the Procrastination Research Group since 1995 and has written a short book about how to deal with procrastination, because a longer one would make people just put other things off longer. The book is called Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, A Concise Guide to Strategies for Change. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. That's anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, you can use 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Tim, you have a particular structure for each chapter to make it easier as well for the procrastinators to move quickly through the book. Would you lay out the structure of each?
Sure. I start with a mantra. That's just something we can keep in our own minds when we think about mindfulness meditation, for example, and that is something that's really quite effective with regards to goal pursuit. But a mantra might be, you know, concentrating on one's breath. One of my favorites is just get started. So I just keep that in my own mind, just get started, and I roll that over and over. So with each chapter, I try to condense it into one phrase. That came from my own teaching. I've always been trying to do that for any lecture I was about to give. Can I sum it up in a sentence? And so I start there. And then I move to a short story about something in real life that captures the main point of the chapter, because all of this is from lived experience, and often these things come from people that I've either participated in our research or have talked to me about their procrastination. Then I do a little bit of theory and research, but I keep it brief. I keep it to the point. I don't reference many things specifically. I just get to the main concepts, and then I move to some strategies for change. So if we understand it works this way, so what do we do to change? And interspersed in there, a few years back, I started a comic strip with a good friend of mine who's a cartoonist and a clever man, and we've tried to capture some of the concepts in cartoons as well, just to make them more memorable. So the whole thing is that you should be able to skim this book in an hour even, And then those things that really resonate with you, go back and read those and then put it into effect. The key thing is that we don't make change in our lives just by reading, but by grabbing onto a couple of ideas and then moving forward with them. So that's the structure. And it's funny you asked me about the length of the book. My dad over the Christmas holidays said, "So how long did it take you to write the book?" I said, 15 or 20 years. And he laughed and said, "No." I mean, I know that's the research part of it, but how long does it take? I said, well, it only took me a couple of months of writing, but it was really paring it down because my students have written hundreds of pages of theses, and I've written lots and lots of blog posts and articles myself. And the idea for me was, well, how do I make this digestible? Because it's easy to procrastinate by reading more about procrastination. In fact, John Perry from Stanford University wrote a brilliant book, and he argues that, yeah, you've got to be very cautious about, you know, reading more about procrastination. It's a black hole. So that's the structure of the book, and my goal was to make it something that you could read and then move on with change.
So it sounds like you really gave yourself a larger editing project than a writing one, because you really had to go back and say, no, I really need to get it down to this bare essence.
Absolutely. In fact, you said earlier that, you know, I've done this blog for Psychology Today, and up until that point, I was doing all my writing in journals and for book chapters and for scholars. And then the Psychology Today, one of the editors there, Libby Ma, contacted me and said, would you do a blog for us? And I said, well, I don't really write like that, and I'm too busy. And she said, oh, I'll just give it a try. Well, I'm glad that I did, because I took a whole new approach to writing, and I realized that I really learned a lot in trying to be concise for a different audience. And so, yes, I had all of these blog posts, which you can read freely on Psychology Today's website. And then I thought, well, you know, not everybody goes to a blog site. Let's try to condense that. And so it was a big editing project, Jeff.
And the blog is called Don't Delay at the Psychology Today website. You even get to the meaning of the phrase carpe diem, and you force us to stop to think about the fact that it can be viewed either way. Either the procrastinators can say, oh, yeah, I'm going to seize the day by having a good time today, and I'll worry about the other thing tomorrow. Or the people who believe in getting their job done are talking about seizing the day and getting their job done now.
Yes, and it's that latter group that I'm really interested in, because a lot of procrastinators will try to defend the situation and say, well, I don't want to be that uptight productive guy. You know, that's there's no more spontaneity in life. And in fact, the opposite is true. When you do the tasks that are required of you in a timely way, you really open up your day. You free yourself really mentally. We all know the nagging task that's hanging on that you've left undone. Even Viktor Frankl, the Viennese psychiatrist who spent time in a Nazi concentration camp, in his autobiography wrote about procrastination, and he wrote about how he always starts the day with the difficult jobs. And it really struck me that here's a man who had so many things to teach us and actually spent a bit of time talking about procrastination as well, because it really is one of the things that drags us down.
Psychologist Timothy Pitchell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. Let's take some calls here. Cindy in Neyland, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. This is a very interesting topic, and I've always been a person who has something that I feel I need to do. I dread doing it. I know full well it's going to be fairly easy to do, but I don't do it. Then I got a calendar, one of those computer calendar things. I found if I write down, like for the next week, that I'm going to do this on this day, then I seem to feel not that dread of doing it. I do most of it anyway, and I was wondering why that happens.
Interesting. So it's a scheduling thing. You're really providing a structure for yourself from the sounds of it.
Well, I'm providing an order from the machine as versus my own internal orders.
All right, let's explore that then with Tim. Thanks for the call, Cindy. Tim, what do you think?
Well, Cindy, I think it's an interesting thing you started with today, and that when you use a tool like that, you can call it extended cognition. And so you can stop thinking about it anymore. You don't have to perseverate on it or even think about it again, because you've got it scheduled. One of the biggest things we can do is move from vague goal intentions to specific implementation intentions, and a tool like that can help. You know exactly when you're going to act. And if you live up to your calendar, then your life is more structured and it makes it easier. Sometimes the dread is, well, I've seen it in our own research when I talked about that pager study. People always thought the task was more difficult and less enjoyable than when they actually got down to it. And so you've filled that gap by saying, okay, this is when I plan to do it. And you can let go of it for a little while. You've got a real plan.
Do we tend to see tasks as monolithic, as something monumental, like trying to climb Mount Everest, when it really is just a series of foothills?
Well, I think sometimes they are Mount Everest, but, you know, that old saying, even the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and that's why my favorite mantra is just get started. I'll often face a task every day. Just because I write about procrastination doesn't mean I don't want to do it some days. Now, I usually can't do it because I can't escape myself anymore. I've got too much understanding of this process of wanting to give in to feel good now. So instead, I just say to myself, let's just get started, Tim. So I could be looking at that mountain, but I just say, well, let's just take a few steps. Like, you're not climbing the whole mountain today. Let's just take a few steps. And of course, what other researchers have shown us is that progress on a goal, even a little, fuels our well-being. And that creates this upward spiral, and we got a bit more motivation. So I always start with the most basic, just get started.
Let's take another call. Here is Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking procrastination with Dr. Timothy Pitchell.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Good morning, Timothy.
Good morning. You can call me Tim.
Oh, Tim, I bet you have a small book on a big coffee table.
That's not why
I called.
Go ahead.
To put it in a nutshell, let me start this out with a joke. Hey, Tim, they had a thing called Procrastinators Anonymous.
Yes.
Nobody showed up.
For sure. There's so many good jokes that way. I have a favorite. Can I tell it, Jeff?
Sure.
Sure.
So there's two people from different cultures, one from Mexico and another from Ireland, and they've been on a cultural exchange and sharing all sorts of things together. And finally, the Mexican fellow says, you know, in our language we have a concept called mañana. Do you have anything like that in Irish? And the Irishman thinks for a while, and he says, yes, but nothing with that sense of urgency. And that's my favorite.
All right.
Timothy, thank you. Timothy, before I hang up, because I do this, you're not aware, I'm a regular on the Jefferson Exchange. Jeffrey, may I ask your guest a question?
Yes, that's why you're here.
Thumbnail. Procrastination and perfectionism go hand in hand. How do you make the one slap the other one on the wrist and say, no, you're not perfect, but let's go on from here?
All right, perfectionism and procrastination. Good dichotomy to bring up. Thanks for that, Jamie.
Yes, thanks so much for that question, Jamie. Well, there's not just one flavor of perfectionism. Gordon Flett, Canada Research Chair at the York University in Toronto, has done a lot of work on perfectionism, and he defines three different kinds, and I'm just going to focus on two. One is a self-oriented perfectionist, and this person does something well for him or herself just because they have those standards and they're working to achieve their own goals. But then there's the socially prescribed perfectionist. This is the person that has internalized the unrealistic expectations of others. And you'll know this in yourself if you hear the dialogue with that person in your own mind. It could be an internalized parent or teacher. In a cartoon land, it would be a little person sitting on your shoulder talking into your ear saying, that's not good enough, you know. And we see the socially prescribed perfectionists tend to procrastinate more than the self-oriented. In fact, the self-oriented procrastinate less. So in a sense, those are the people who use perfectionism actually to give themselves a boot in the butt, because they're not being undermined by unrealistic expectations. They just want to do a job well. So I think it's a great question, Jamie, because there's more than one type of perfectionist. I hope that helps.
And Tim, you say, let me remind our audience that we're talking to Tim Pitchell, who's the author of Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. You can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. You have already said not all delay is procrastination, but so how do we know the difference between delay and procrastination?
Often it's the feelings that are associated with it. I delay things every day. I'm sure you do, too. In fact, you could have delayed the interview today had you needed to, if there's something else that came up that was more urgent, some important news story. Delay is part of setting priorities. But procrastination has nothing to do with priorities. It has everything to do with, I don't feel like doing it. If that's the thought or emotion that's going attached to the task, you know you're talking about procrastination at that point. So procrastination is you have an intention to act now. You know you should act now. There's nothing in the way except your own reluctance to start, whereas other forms of delay are truly just rationalizing the best approach for the day. So there's sagacious delay, where we delay because we need more information, or we know that we can act better later. And then there's procrastination, where we really are becoming our own worst enemy, and we're kind of lamenting. A part of it ourselves is watching the other part slip away, and that's very close to when we see it related to depression. We have similar feelings when we watch one part of ourselves slip away.
You mentioned the depression. There are some other long-term effects, apparently, from procrastination. It's other than just, you know, sloppy work generally turned in right by deadline.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to start there in that when we look at the relation between performance and procrastination, although it's negative, procrastination is never really helpful, it's not that powerful. It's not like anyone who procrastinates puts in a bad job. That's not the case. In fact, you talked earlier about my thesis students. I have many. Lots of students come and want to work with me because procrastination is part of student life, and these are A-plus students, but they do lament the fact they wait to the last minute. What became more interesting for us is when we looked at the health effects. Now, Fuchsia Sirwa was a student at our university, is now a professor at Bishop's University in Sherbrooke, Quebec, Canada Research Chair as well. She's done a lot of work on health and procrastination, and we've seen that a higher procrastination leads to more health complaints, partly because of the increased stress, so we have a direct effect, and then indirect effects of lack of wellness behaviors and more treatment delay. So we also have behavioral effects of our tendency to put things off. So those effects are much more important, and there's also social effects that we really get on other people's nerves, and we let people down. So if I procrastinate during the day and I don't get my work done, then my son might come up and say, "Well, let's play tonight, Dad," and I say, "Oh, no, I'm too busy." That is a cost to my son of procrastination. We have to recognize it as such. It's not really just a cost to self.
We have an email here from Jennifer in Roseburg, Oregon. She says, sure, I don't work better under pressure, but as you said, but seems I can only work under pressure. I can only work under pressure, not for the handicap reason you gave or because I think I work better under pressure. I've watched it, and it seems that when there's enough adrenaline behind the task, that is when I'm suddenly able to see the first steps clearly, or sometimes it's the point at which I can actually envision the entire process the task will require. Without that adrenaline or whatever it is, I can spend days or weeks seeing the task as a big, muddy, tangled mess that I can't see the starting point on. So just get started rarely works for me if I can't feel the pressure that brings me that vision. I'd love a technique for seeing the process clearly before it becomes critical. Any suggestions? Also, have you looked at procrastination in light of any personality type theories? That again from Jennifer in Roseburg.
Okay, great questions. The first one is that we're all a little bit different in terms of our tolerance for that kind of motivation. So there's certainly a inverse curve there that we do need a certain amount of anxiety, and our performance actually increases as that anxiety builds. But that curve is different for every person. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't leave things a little bit, and we don't have to start things the moment they're assigned to us. But when we get to the point where it's extreme, then we have to look at what Jennifer's asking for, other strategies. And some of that becomes setting earlier internal deadlines and sticking to them, of course, because we can use a little self-deception that way and then realize, it doesn't matter. But we can try to move that up to spur us on. Some people say that, you know, it gets them into a real flow condition. This is a concept that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi defined that athletes and musicians get into. And although we can get the hyper-concentration with these last-minute efforts and see things more clearly, perhaps, as Jennifer said, what the difference is that the flow experiences of athletes and musicians and others comes from experience and practice and discipline. So again, I would offer to her that she needs to work on a more daily basis. Good writers do. They'll write it at the same time every day, so there's a unconscious pre-writing process. So some of it comes down to changing work habits. The follow-up question was about personality. Well, we talked a little bit about perfectionism, but there are five major personality traits that kind of define personality as the three colors do in a color wheel. And one of the key ones here is a personality trait called conscientiousness. And it really goes back to Cindy's question, too, about organization, in the sense that conscientious people are organized, they're dutiful, they're self-disciplined, and they naturally would do what Cindy does, where they would use a list and a calendar, and those people don't procrastinate very much. Like all major personality traits, these have high, conscientiousness has a high heritability coefficient. It's partly nature. So we come into the world with a propensity to maybe put things off unnecessarily, and if we do, we're going to have to work harder strategically not to procrastinate. And there's one other I should talk about, Jeffrey, and that's impulsiveness. If you're a really impulsive individual, it's difficult to protect one intention from another. You're off doing something else before you even notice it. And there again, we have to be more strategic. We have to use those pre-decisions to say, if situation X comes up, like I get offered to go out tonight, I will say no. And research by Peter Galwitzer has shown us that those pre-decisions are very effective.
I found myself squirming just a little bit when Jennifer was writing about getting a task started, because I find that among broadcasters, or maybe it's just me, when you're faced with daily deadlines, the ones that are longer term, like I need to do this in a week or two, we do tend to wait until it becomes the next day.
Yes, but you know, I did a podcast with a graduate student earlier this year, and it was a very popular podcast, partly because it became from someone who was dealing with a procrastination's mouth. And she talks about the fact that she had to deal with all their short-term projects, but she always made time daily for those long-term projects. And anybody that deals with time management will say the same thing. You have to be very deliberate. It's a bit like having a date with your spouse when you're busy with other things in life. You have to be deliberate, or you'll find weeks will go by and you're never seeing one another. And the same thing with those long-term projects. You got to give them a little time, even though they're not urgent, and just get started on them. And then I think some of that crystallization that Jennifer talks about might happen.
So again, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and take those first few steps and see if things get a little clearer to you.
That's right. And you know, just because you're not working on a task doesn't mean, like actually typing or something, doesn't mean you're not working on it. A little incubation is a good idea too.
Tim Pinchel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, A Concise Guide to Strategies for Change. We do have some phone calls waiting. We will take those and invite more. Join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk about procrastination and how you've dealt with it in your own life. Back with Tim Pinchel and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is psychologist Dr. Timothy Pinchel from Carleton University in Ottawa. He also writes the blog Don't Delay for Psychology Today. His book is Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, A Concise Guide to Strategies for Change. Join us to share your stories about procrastination and what it has done for you in your life, good or bad. Maybe there are times when procrastination really did you good. We want to hear those stories as well. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send us an email. Those go to jx@jeffnet.org. Elizabeth in Eureka, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hello. I had a question about the relationship, if there is any research on a relationship between dissociation and trauma and procrastination. I've been reading about trauma, and I was surprised to see that one of the symptoms of trauma can be hoarding behavior. Huh. I'm wondering if it made me think there might be a relationship.
All right, good question. Thanks for that, Elizabeth.
It is a great question, Elizabeth. There's no specific research done to date on trauma and procrastination, but one of my students just this past summer presented a paper at a conference on hoarding and procrastination. And when she went into this, she was looking at obsessive compulsive disorder and hoarding in relation to procrastination. I really didn't know where she was going with it, but she did find an association. And now she's trying to unpack that theoretically. So you've offered something else up here, which may be that there's something to do with trauma, but no research to date on that. How do you think it might work?
All right. And Elizabeth, are you still there?
Hello?
Yes, you there?
I haven't thought about it a lot. I'm reading about trauma right now, so it's kind of on my mind.
All right. Yeah. Just the kind of thing, we're trying not to deal with things in the present, I'm thinking. What do you think, Tim?
Well, that and also trauma really disrupts our ability to stay focused. You know, attention is the first step in volitional control in terms of willful action. And trauma really does break down our ability to stay focused. And so it may be that's part of it too. But trauma is wide-reaching in its effects on us. And so there may be a few places that it really interferes with our ability to be planful, our executive function, or to execute a plan. So I think there's a lot in there that remains to be seen, Elizabeth, but I would be quite certain that trauma would affect our ability to effectively go after our goals.
All right, Elizabeth, thanks for that. Let's go on to Dan and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Pitchell.
Good morning. Yeah, listening to this conversation after while I was calling, I was wondering about, because I'm a procrastinist and a perfectionist, but I seem to reach for the phone as a tool to resolve some questions, and I wonder if it's more impulsive to get to the end and sort of give me an excuse to procrastinate.
Is the phone a diversion then, or are you using it to actually help you with
the task? No, as a tool, not as a diversion, but a tool to get more answers to resolve the problem I may have to take care of it.
All right, Tim, what do you think?
Well, Dan, it's interesting that your choice might be the phone. A lot of people's choice is the Internet, and they'll use it to find information. And then about 15 minutes later, or maybe even 3 hours later, they wonder, why am I on this website? Because we make rational decisions over irrationally short periods of time. So we'll make a rational decision that I'm just going to check this out because of this. And then you'll see another association, and you say, it will only take me a minute. And each time you make this rational decision, it will only take a minute. But it is over an irrationally short period of time, because in the next minute you make the same decision. And 3 hours later, you realize you're researching something that really isn't so related to your original problem. And so I think it cuts both ways. We can have these fantastic tools, but as Jeff asked at the beginning, at some point it may become a diversion. And we're very good at self-deception. It's an interesting process where we can kind of convince ourselves that we're still on task, even though part of us knows that we're not anywhere near what we should be doing at the time. So I don't think that's a complete answer to your question, Dan, but I wanted to point out what a great point you raised by saying that you can start by using something as a tool, but then it can lead us in other directions.
Dan, thanks for that. Which raises the question, Tim, whether with the Internet around us and information at our fingertips pretty much all the time, whether procrastination has become somewhat worse. I mean, with all these devices at our disposal, do we tend to go straight for those instead of doing the things we're supposed to be doing?
Yeah, the research that I'm reading tends to agree that procrastination is increasing because of these tools. Everything's just a click away. I'm old enough to remember when there were no remotes for television.
Right.
And people didn't change the station as often. Now there are fewer stations as well. And then remotes came and people did what we call channel surfing. Well, I can remember giving a workshop not long ago to a group of students about this topic on procrastination, and finally one of these attendees, one of the young men, said to me, Dr. Pitchell, I don't know if this is a problem or not, but I spend about 6 hours a day, surfing the net, looking at YouTube videos, updating my Facebook page, and I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, Jeff. Like, 6 hours a day, I said, you could be an Olympic athlete. Do I think it's a problem? Of course it's a problem, right? Like, because it is that slippery slope. We say it'll only take a minute to check update my Facebook status. It'll only take a minute to do this. And we've done that, though. We sat down ostensibly, often, to do some work. And then we don't want to do it. It's aversive to us. So we know we get the immediate satisfaction, maybe even a mood boost from looking at a Facebook page. And 3 hours later, we're still there. So I do see a problem with technology that way. And, of course, it's a very steep and slippery slope into some real addictive behaviors where you're constantly checking your phone. It becomes so habitual that it's a very difficult habit to break. In fact, students who've been asked to stop using their technology go through symptoms that are very withdrawal-like. So I do think there's a very double-edged sword with the power of technology for connecting us and then the power to also disconnect us.
Interesting. Withdrawal symptoms like what? Do they get a little depressed about not being able to have their stuff?
Yeah, they don't want to. They're very resistant. They don't get the shakes and physiological things like that. But the research that I've read about those things that they complain and they can't do it and they can't maintain that. They experience a lot of discomfort. So these are deeply ingrained habits, and they are very distracting, and they are used often as a substitute for the real goal. So they're really specious behaviors. They're not contributing to the things that we need to do or intend to do.
And yet another way for us to procrastinate. The book is Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. Tim Pitchell is author, and here is Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yeah, hi. Well, you just described me to a T. In all the ways you describe using the internet, and sometimes I'm even aware of it, that I'm just putting something off. You know, it's like in the back of my mind, like I know I have to make a decision, but I feel incapable at that time of making the decision. But I wanted to link this to the earlier caller question about trauma. I think there's definitely got to be a link there, and I hope somebody's researching this somewhere. I'm studying early childhood education at the moment, and that brings me back to revisiting concepts like Erickson's psychosocial stages of growth. And I'm thinking that often procrastination and trauma might be linked because if you go back to, let's see, which is the first stage is safety versus not being safe. And if a child grows up not feeling safe, then they move into the area of autonomy versus shame and self-doubt. If they don't get their autonomy supported, they end up living with a lot of self-doubt, which really, I think, affects there's another concept called executive function about the parts of the brain that develop that allow us to function, you know, and to grow up to be, you know, relatively organized and productive adults. But anyway, I'd be curious to hear any thoughts you have about that.
All right. Thanks for that, Sandy. Appreciate it. Tim?
Well, that's excellent, Sandy. I'll start with the last comment about executive function. I would argue that it's all about executive function. There's only one neurological study or neuropsychological study linking executive function to procrastination, but not surprisingly, they found that the better the executive function, the lower the procrastination. And in fact, I think a lot of the interventions are around developing better executive function skills. And so I think as we see more physiological research done, we'll see more of a mapping of the prefrontal cortex onto our inability at times to get on with our intentions. But your other comments about Erickson are rather interesting, too. I totally agree with you that autonomy is huge. That sense of agency, you know, in your own comments where you sometimes see yourself slipping away, but you can't seem to bring yourself back. And I think that it really is a deep sense of one's agency that saves us, and we need to foster that in young people, that sense of autonomy and that real sense of choice. And, of course, if that's disrupted, as you say, in your development, it's going to create a problem. There's only one study that I know, and it was one of my students who's now a doctoral student at Western University. He did a study on Erickson's stages of identity, and he came to me years ago and said, you know, I think students who have achieved their identity will procrastinate less. And to make a long story short, that's what he found. If we've achieved our identity, we're less likely to procrastinate, and he related that to both ego-synthetic and ego-executive functioning. So you really said a lot there, Sandy, and it describes a lot of what it means to understand that self-control that we need so that we don't get that feeling of, I can't pull myself out of here. Autonomy, agency, executive function. That was well said, Sandy.
Okay, so this is a big one because, as you point out, that procrastination is a problem with self-regulation. So the more mature you are, the better you know yourself, the better self-regulated. So essentially, the better you feel about yourself, the less likely you are to procrastinate?
Well, certainly, there's two things there. Yeah, certainly, if you're feeling better about yourself, if you have higher self-esteem, you're less likely to procrastinate because you're not trying to protect yourself all the time, that self-handicapping sort of notion. But it's more than that, that it is about self-regulation. It's self-regulatory skills. And in that sense, there's almost a developmental stage. If I go back to Sandy's comment, no one would fault a young child for not understanding conservation of volume. If I played a trick on them and I transferred fluid from one short glass to a tall glass, and they said, oh, there's more in the tall glass, we wouldn't think they were stupid somehow. But we see a lot of people in their teens who are having problems with procrastination, and we sometimes we think they have some moral failing. And in fact, what they need is more support. They need more structure, and that gradually has to be removed as they develop executive functioning skills. And in fact, in parenting studies, we find that those parents who are more controlling have more problems with children with procrastination because they never learn to internalize their goals and to develop self-control. And it even goes back to Walter Mischel's work, of course, on delay of gratification. If you can delay gratification and not want to feel good now, you're less likely to procrastinate. And all these are just really basic essential skills that will set a foundation for any goal that we want to pursue.
Let us take another call. Here's Dawn in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Pitchell. His book is Solving the Procrastination Puzzle.
Very interesting discussion. Thank you for taking my call. And you're hitting the nail on the head for me right now, because I was just calling about my teenage son who happens to be at boarding school, and we're just hit with the crux of the issue of he's struggling academically, exceeding in his the reason he's there for his program, arts program. He's enjoying that thoroughly. But when it comes down to getting the work done to be able to stay there academically, how best to support him? And it's hard to tease it all apart with the executive functioning, with learning disabilities, with fetal alcohol syndrome, all of those issues overlapping on top of each other, how we can help him the most to see his possibilities to succeed.
Oh,
and I'm
agree.
Just wondering if you have any thoughts on how we as parents, other than not being over-controlling.
All right. Thanks for that, Dawn. Appreciate it. Tim,
well,
thoughts?
Dawn, those are really big, challenging questions. Just at 10 o'clock this morning here, we're a little bit ahead of you. I had a tutor in for my daughter who has challenges in reading, and it's interesting to watch her squirm and not want to do it and do the hard work of struggling to go from sounds to words. My daughter's only 8, and she's a very capable young girl, but she has problems reading. And I ask myself the same question, you know, how are we going to help my daughter best? And it's priming that pump. We all have to find some route to have her make a little bit of progress and a little bit of success, because it is so hard for them when they're facing all those challenges. Work that we would find, okay, a little bit challenging is exhausting to them, and they just want to squirm away from it. There are no magic bullets. It's a discernment of knowing that person and helping them succeed. If we go back to early theorists like Sandy did, we could talk about the Russian psychologist Vygotsky, who talked about the zone of proximal development, where with another individual's help, they can do just a little bit more than they could on their own. And it's that dance between the educator and the parent and the child to facilitate that progress. Now, the thing is, the motivation's not always there. I understand your frustration where they simply dig their heels in and they say, I don't want to. And the technology is just much more fun, World of Warcraft or whatever it is they're playing. And so we've got a real battle on our hands, and a lot of our boys in particular are suffering. And I wish I had a better answer for you, but of course the time limit is also part of the problem here. But I would always look for those little wins that fuels a little bit of progress, because that's the kind of thing that hooks them.
Tim, we're almost out of time. I just want to ask before we go, though, I mean, 3-year research, about how long a process does it seem to be to kind of turn the tide against procrastination?
Oh, boy. Yeah, save the hardest for the last.
Right.
For some of us, it's a lifelong process, right?
Really?
That you're constantly being strategic about not giving in to feel good, because it's kind of bred in your bone if your personality is stacked against you. For others, a few simple changes, like the very first caller, using technology to plan better makes a big difference. And that's what makes procrastination a lifelong piece of research for me. There's a different constellation of factors. But I would say for most of us, it's a daily strategic effort.
Well, we're glad your fascination has led to this work, Solving the Procrastination Puzzle. Tim Pitchell, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
It was my pleasure, Jeff. Have a great day.
You too. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about the no rainfall record for Medford, the Karuk Casino in Wairika, and we'll talk to Elizabeth Partridge about her godmother, Dorothea Lange, the famous photographer. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Charlotte Duren's our producer, Reed Newland, our student assistant. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.